In a world where action films are dumped in theaters and TV, dead on arrival.
I can't go on living this lie!
You need a hero.
Last time I trusted someone, I lost an eye.
You need a helper.
Hello, hello, nothing to see here.
You need a healer.
That is affirmative.
You need...
We're on the air.
Professor Rick's Action Film Autopsy.
Hey, everybody. It's Rick Myers, and I'd like to say hello to my usual co-hosts, Miko Mai and Jen Hurler, who are not here today. They're off doing other things. Miko, I'm pretty sure, is slaving to finish the latest film from Blue Sky Studios. And Jen is off having adventures. I mean, the last I heard, she was at the Harry Potter world in Universal, and she's going back to school. And I think maybe she's already back at school to get her master's or whatever. So best of luck to them, and off you go. And you don't get to enjoy these last few movies in the dog days of summer. Actually, it's not even the dog days. With the movies we're talking about, we're actually in the good days, in the halcyon days of summer. It's just we've had to wait a while because of a variety of things to get to these three, which have been out in the theaters or out of the theaters for a while now, or at least a couple of days, or whatever. You can look that up. That's not important. But the important thing for me is that these movies represent the true agony and ecstasy of the modern action film, what this podcast is all about, what people are doing completely right and what people are doing completely wrong, and in one case, what people are doing okay. So basically, in addition to the agony and the ecstasy, this is the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's interesting enough to know that the good... And the good is just one film, and we'd have to change that title into the good, the great, the bad, and the ugly, and to include all these films, because one of these films is both the bad and the ugly. Now, if Miko and Jen were here, I'd be able to turn to them and say, okay, which one should I do first? Well, they're not here, so I'm just going to have to ask myself, which one should I do first? And I guess I'll do the one that I love. This is, to my mind, one of the great action films of all time. It's certainly one of the greatest action films of the modern age. I rank this film alongside my other favorites in this area, which would be, I believe, Die Hard, I would believe. Yeah, of course I would believe that, because it's me, after all. I'm telling you my opinion. Die Hard and Lethal Weapon, I considered, were both great action films. Not only was the action great, not only was the movie good, the script was fine, and all the rest of it, but included the things that I look for, or I've come to look for, thanks to those films, in a great action movie, which is effort and emotion, passion and compassion. It's usually involved with the leading character. If the leading character shows effort and emotion, and also passion and compassion, the odds are that will permeate the entire film, and it will be great. And if you think back on the original Die Hard, the original Lethal Weapon, it had those ingredients. It made the audience, I won't even talk about the audience. I'll talk about me, because I can't read anybody else's mind. I can only read my own mind. It made me care. It involved me. It excited me. And that was very, very important. And that is all true of this first movie, which you might have been able to guess by now, at least I certainly hope so, and I can assure you it's not Solo, it's Mission Impossible Fallout. And what's truly remarkable, among many things about this film, is that while Lethal Weapon series and the Die Hard series got worse as they went along, to the point where we got to the last few... Not even the last few. We got to the third Die Hard, and everything after that, all those biodegradable little quickies that they put out after the third Die Hard, these were bad movies. And they got to be terrible. They got to be just, you know, let's put it out there because people are willing to go see it, so we have guaranteed money and we don't have to work that hard to come up with something as good as the first Die Hard and arguably the second Die Hard. Same was true with Lethal Weapon, the Lethal Weapon series. Third one got a little gloopy. The fourth one, I believe it's the fourth one, right? We'll check it. You can check the supplementals to see if I got this right. I believe the fourth one had was the one that brought over Jet Li. And it made him look good because he was good. But the movie itself was just, they were just having fun. I mean, basically, Richard Donner, the director, and the cast were just slumming it. While Jet wouldn't slum it, so that's why he looks so good in that movie, if it is 4 that I'm thinking of and not 3. Pretty sure it is 4, but in any case, it's in the supplementals. But in any case, those series got worse, much worse, as they went on. While Mission Impossible, and again, arguably the Fast and the Furious, are getting better as they go on. Actually, I don't even think that's that arguable. I mean, Mission Impossible, however, is getting better, so much better, that it puts whatever the gradation of the Fast and the Furious getting better to shame, because it's a great movie. Fast and the Furious are fun movies, and it's great fun, but Mission Impossible Fallout is a great movie, and it's certainly a great action movie. And I attribute this mostly to the writer-director, not so much the star, although Tom Cruise is pretty astonishing as to what he's willing to do. Tom Cruise has fairly clearly with this film become the American Jackie Chan, although he's doing it at the age of 50, even though Jackie is 63 or 64 at this point. I think he's 64 as of April. And his films are kind of slumming it. And he's 64 years old. Tom Cruise, over 50, and who knows how old he actually is. I can't take anything that's in the press or in the media or anything probably his office even says as truth. Might be true, might not. It's pretty good guarantee, though, that he's over 50. And he is doing, it looks like he's doing all his own stunts. He certainly is doing some of those stunts very, very clearly. When we went to see, when myself and my friends Frank Jeng and his wife Vivian Wong went to see Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, we went to this wonderful IMAX theater in Sacramento, and they showed a short subject on the making of the final helicopter sequence in Mission Impossible Fallout to show off how glorious the IMAX filming was. And it was glorious. It was eye-widening. It was almost jaw-dropping. And I'm kind of sorry I didn't see the film in IMAX, but that's still okay. It's still an awesome movie. And again, I attribute a lot of that to McQuarrie, Christopher McQuarrie, who wrote it and directed it. I thought the direction was, there were some moments in the movie, even though I didn't see it in IMAX theater, I saw it in a normal, high-def movie theater. There were some shots in it, not even the action shots, just some images, some frames, some framing sequences where I nodded. I was impressed. My eyebrows rose. Very nicely designed stuff, some beautiful stuff. And he puts it together beautifully, but that is not as awesome to me as what he did with the script. One of the things, Tom Cruise is not only the Jackie Chan of for America, but he has sort of taken the mantle of a very famous comedian and comic actor named Jack Benny. I think I've mentioned him on this podcast before. What was so great about Jack Benny is that he surrounded himself with a lot of very talented actors and characters, and he always let them shine. He always let them shine. I was trying to think, since it's in the past, I was going to do the past tense of shine, which is shown, but he didn't let them shone. He let them shine. And that made him look better. The great thing about Jack Benny is he was a dry comedian in that usually his silences and just a couple of words he would say in a dry kind of manner was what made it funny. He didn't make a lot of funny voices or do any crazy things like, say, Jerry Lewis or whatever. He was a very quiet. He was the center of the storm, and the storm raged around him. And the way he reacted to the storm, as all his other characters went crazy and did crazy things, made it funny and made him extremely likable. Again, I always talk about how much I like to be involved in the movie I'm seeing. I like to react. I like to get excited. I like to want to cheer. I want to dodge when the certain things are happening on screen, things like that. So Tom Cruise, who for many years, as recently as his horrible abortive mummy movie, had a problem in that he wouldn't let anyone else shine. It's fairly clear, and I know from a lot of reports from the set, that there are times when Tom Cruise, everything has to be about Tom Cruise on certain Tom Cruise movies. All the best lines, all the best actions. The Mummy was a great example of that. Everybody was there to support Tom's desire to be a god, because by the end of the movie, he had become a god. And I said, well, all right, now I know why you chose this movie. But in especially in the last two, this Mission Impossible Fallout is a direct sequel to Rogue Nation, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. And it was in that movie, again, Christopher McQuarrie directing, where Tom learned to share. When the movie was benefited by the fact that Tom let all the other major characters have a moment, have more than one moment, have a scene. He let them look good, which wound up making him look good. And it made me very happy and satisfied about that movie. But Mission Impossible Fallout goes one step further. Again, thanks to the contributions, I believe, of Christopher McQuarrie, in that, like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the last movie I could think of that did the same sort of thing was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. There were hundreds of other movies in history, in cinema history, that were in the same genre as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, a genre called wuxia, which is heroic chivalry films, basically the Chinese equivalent of the Marvel or the DC cinematic comic universe, where we had individual characters with individual names, individual weapons, individual clothes, outfits, doing all these amazing things. And the reason that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon wound up making more money than all those other movies, wound up winning more awards, certainly more Oscars, won four Oscars, than all those other previous series, is that Ang Lee, the director, did something that none of those previous directors did, which was he attached the character's emotions directly to the action. The action happened because of the needs and motivations and desires of the characters. In short, for Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, their bodies were doing what their hearts could not. They were flying and floating because they had an emotional repression that manifested itself in powers throughout their body. Now, you may not believe that, but in terms of the film and why you're watching that particular movie, that's what elevated Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon above all the other hundreds, if not thousands, of previous wuxia films. Mission Impossible Fallout does the same thing. What elevated that movie above the previous Mission Impossibles, and certainly the Fast and the Furious, is that as I watched it, I was able to attach the desires of the characters directly to the action. The action scene didn't exist in a vacuum. As you know, my feeling is most of the time when an action scene starts, it's almost completely divorced from the rest of the film. It's just like, okay, second unit moves in, they do the action scene, and then we'll get back to the characters and the plot as soon as the action scene is over. Empty, what I call empty movement. It's one of the several things I call empty movement. That's not the only thing I call empty movement. The kind of things that happened in the Star Wars prequels where they were just kind of swinging their arms and it really didn't make any legitimate mental sense, that's empty movement. Just action for the sake of action. Action that looks cool but doesn't make you feel or think anything. That is not true in Mission Impossible Fallout. Every single action sequence is attached to at least one character, if not more. And they're doing things not because it says so in the script that, okay, now we need an action sequence. They're doing things specifically for other reasons. to save someone else, to save themselves, to stop other people. It goes beyond the normal stuff. Usually in an action film, they're fighting and they're shooting and they're whatever in order to save other people or save the day or save the world. This is more intimate in Mission Impossible Fallout. They're doing it for that reason, yes, but they're also dealing with a specific emotional situation they're dealing with at that moment while you're watching it. And it really elevated everything. It also made it stronger and more interesting, more involving. I was able to actually feel things for the characters. I was able to hope for them. I sat in the audience going, gee, I hope he accomplishes this because I care about him. And I haven't always cared about Tom Cruise, and I certainly haven't always cared about Henry Cavill. Poor Henry Cavill. Henry was in the shortlist. In fact, he was one of the last two people left to play the new James Bond when they were making Casino Royale. And Martin Campbell, the director, wanted Henry Cavill as the new James Bond, while the producers wanted Daniel Craig. And they got Daniel Craig, or as I call him, the born-again Bond, i.e. the Jason born-again Bond. And because Bond has had a history of, especially since Live and Let Die, the first Roger Moore James Bond, of trying to steal from whatever's popular or knock off whatever's popular at the time. So Jason Bourne was popular at the time. So suddenly James Bond became a Jason Bourne look-alike and act-alike or whatever. But Henry Cavill, so he didn't get the James Bond role, but of course he got the Superman role. But he got the Superman role at a time when the DC Cinematic Universe wanted to turn Superman into a mentally constipated, monosyllabic, spoiled, pouty, depressive. And I remember interviews with Cavill at the time where he was striving very hard not to break the rule of Hollywood. And the rule of Hollywood is to take the money and shut up. Take the money and don't reveal anything. Don't tell anybody what's going on behind the scenes. Just take the money and shut up. He was clearly so frustrated with the way the Man of Steel came out that if you go back and look at it, if they haven't taken those interviews out of circulation, he was concerned he would never play Superman again because he thought it was going to be a gigantic failure. And then seeing him get even worse as a character in the subsequent movies, and even in Justice League, where he seemed happier because at least they were trying to return Superman to his original representation, his original concept. He seemed happier, but of course he had a weird thing on his upper lip because he had his mustache still from Mission Impossible Fallout, and they had to digitally erase it. And it made it look like there was an invisible caterpillar crawling on his upper lip throughout the film. So, however, once I saw Mission Impossible Fallout, I saw Cavill being able to play a part without fighting with the director, without having to disagree with the director or try not to do what the director is telling him. And I felt that he was ecstatic. His happiness permeated the screen for me and came to me in my seat, and I was very, very, very happy for him. And now I just hope that whatever they do with him next, he's able to be unleashed. Because in Mission Impossible Fallout, that was a little hint of what Henry Cavill could really do if he is just allowed to exalt in his acting and his acting ability. So in any case, Mission Impossible Fallout, just awesome. So now the question here is, do I go to the agony and the ugly, or the bad and the ugly, the agony, the bad and the ugly? No, I'll save that. I'll save that for the wrap up. I'll save that for the end of the trilogy. We'll just quickly take care of the Meg. We'll get the Meg out of the way, as it were, because that's the kind of movie it is. It's also not kind of the good, the bad, or the ugly. It's just kind of like, oh, it's the okay. It's the fine. Here we have the wonderful and lovely Jason Statham, who I am greatly enamored of, for the reason is that no matter how bad the movie Jason Statham is in, he refuses to slum. He refuses to do anything that he feels his character wouldn't do. A good example of that is in the Fast and the Furious movies. He will not, oh, better, no, that's not true. Actually, let's jump back. Let me erase that, move that over to the side for the moment. It's a good example of it is in the Mechanic film he made. He made the sequel to the Mechanic, the Charles Bronson action film. I think it was Mechanic Resurrection. And I could clearly see in that movie, as stupid as that movie was, Jason Statham seemingly refused to allow his character to do stupid things. He still did very, when he was called upon to do action, he seemed to try very hard to do it realistically, not to do it in a fanciful, ludicrous way. When you see certain other movies, I think it was Hitman. What's the movie that's based on the video game where the character has a barcode on the back of his neck? I'll look it up. It'll be in the supplementals. But that's a good example. And some of the later Die Hard movies are great examples of where they just let the action go crazy. And the action makes no sense. Even in the third Die Hard, all the characters were suffering injuries, or should have been suffering injuries, that would have killed them 30 times over. Except, you know, they fall 30 feet onto a piece of metal and they just groan a little, get up and keep moving. But Jason Statham doesn't do that. And also, to my mind, The Rock has been a great and a terrible influence on Jason Statham, in that once they were teamed up in the Fast and the Furious movies, those movies became much more fun. And now that they're planning a spin-off series of Fast and Furious movies starring only Jason Statham and The Rock without Vin Diesel, I'm really looking forward to that. And I hope that's just fun personified. I hope that's the ecstasy of fun. I think the two characters they're playing, one is clearly a son of Hercules, and the other one is a spinoff from Jet Li and Jackie Chan and all these guys, and you can guess which one is which. So in any case, so we have The Rock doing Skyscraper and Rampage and Jumanji, and so it looked like now that he's hotter and he's able to get into A-minus films or B-plus films, he's still not in total A-movie territory yet. He's still doing B-films, basically. Jason Statham says, all right, I'm going to have my Skyscraper/Rampage for the summer, and that is The Meg. And The Meg is clearly a B-film because it is so derivative. I mean, Skyscraper, as I've mentioned on a previous podcast, was The Rock's homage to many of the films he liked. It was clearly not an original film. It was clearly a knockoff of Towering Inferno and many, many other things. And so is The Meg. The Meg is a knockoff of Jaws and every big, ugly, nasty, mean fish movie that has come in the wake of Jaws. In the wake. It is kind of like an ocean-related pun or play on words. So The Meg is fine. The Meg is pretty much what you would expect from a knockoff of Jaws starring Jason Statham and co-produced by the Chinese cinema. And so, yeah, there you go. But like Skyscraper, more like Jumanji, the Rock version of Jumanji, it is better than I was expecting. I was expecting mediocrity. And it's a little better than mediocrity. So what happens is, when I walk into a movie theater expecting mediocrity, I'm pleasantly surprised when it's not mediocrity, when it's a little better than mediocrity. So I cut it a lot of slack. I cut it slack without even, as soon as something kind of clever happens or kind of cute, or in this case, John Turteltaub, who I believe also made a National Treasure movies with Nicolas Cage, and again, I'll check on that and it'll be in the supplementals. He did a nice professional job. Things were kind of snappy. and they moved along, and nothing was, you know, like groaningly bad. In fact, some things were groaningly good and okay and fun and satisfying and nice. And I liked it. I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot more than I liked the we're getting it to it now. Here we go. We're coming to it. Here it is. The ugly, the bad, the agony. I was amazed by Mile 22. I thought Mile 22 was good, given all was going to be good. And it's got Mark Wahlberg, who I appreciate and at times admire. It's directed by Peter Berg, who I tolerate. I've never thought anything he's done has been really, really, really good. I think most of the stuff I've seen him do, I've seen of his, has been self-conscious. A kind of, you know, look at me, look how I can edit stuff, and look at me doing these shots and doing these little technical tricks. And I call it, I don't like movies that really call heavy attention to themselves. I like movies where I can enjoy it while I'm in the theater and be completely submerged or riding on the experience that they create for me, not one where I feel just out of shot. The director is turning to me and going, see what I did there? It's funny, that actually happened one time. I worked on a couple of television shows back in the 80s and 90s. And I've been in the room where they show the film. Why am I blanking on that? It's how far are we into this podcast? Usually when I get to this length of the podcast, I stop. See, I just did it again. I stopped being able to use words. I get to a point where I've used so many words that I stop being able to think of them. I mean, these are words like the. But in any case, so I'm in the screening room the day after the shooting where we're going through the rushes. Thank you. We're going through the rushes. And I've actually experienced several times when a director of the particular episode will get up, walk to the screen, and start telling the producer or executive producer or showrunner, you see, this is what I was trying to do. See what I was doing here? This is what I was trying to do. You see how that connects up? And invariably, when a director does that, they know they're in deep doo-doo. They know that what they've done is not very good. It's kind of like a little kid who's kind of like making excuses for his terrible book report or whatever. And that's the way I always felt with Peter Berg movies. But Mile 22 goes so beyond that in terms of astonishment and awfulness that I was dumbfounded, which is saying something because I'm usually not dumbfounded. I may be dumb and I may be founded, but I'm rarely dumbfounded. I mean, I've seen movies like The Good Dinosaur where I can say that it's inexplicable. But this is not inexplicable. Mile 22 is kind of eminently explicable. There are certain aspects of it that are a little inexplicable, but mostly it's dumbfounding in its dumbness and its awfulness. Not even dumb. It's not even particularly dumb. It's just awful. And this is, and now we'll go through why. First of all, in the press, Mark Wahlberg, who, again, I like, and I think he has good possibilities, and I've enjoyed many of his movies, or at least several of them, has said that he is looking, he wants to get in on the franchise action. All these other people, thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Tom Cruise and Jason Statham and The Rock, are getting to play characters in more movies in a series. They have a franchise. And Mark Wahlberg thought that Mile 22 was going to be his franchise. And in fact, the poster makes a point of saying, the main tagline for the poster here is option one, diplomacy. Option two, military. Meet option three, Mark Wahlberg. Okay. All right. I saw the poster. I went in expecting that it was going to be option three. And I didn't realize that option three is, for the want of a better term, an a-hole. So it should have said option one, diplomacy, option two, military, option three, an a-hole. The character he plays in this movie, James Silva, is an astonishing jerk. I mean, astonishing. He is rude. He is stupid. He is hyper. He is, oh God, you can come up with any negative word, and this guy's it. He's so insufferable and annoying and irritating and in your face. I mean, again, I'll try to think of the proper way to describe him, that the movie goes out of the way to say, this guy's a jerk. His people on his side are talking about how annoying and stupid, not stupid, they're not saying he's stupid. He is stupid. He does a lot of incredibly stupid things. But his own characters, that's a really bad sign. It's a bad sign when the characters around the hero start talking about how great he is. That's a bad enough sign. That happened in a couple of Steven Seagal movies where all the characters were falling over themselves just talking about how great Steven Seagal's character was in the particular movie. But that's bad enough because that kind of shows that the star is insecure, so he needs all the other characters in the movie to talk about how great he is. But when you're in a movie where all the other characters are talking about how bad you are, what an idiot you are, how annoying you are, how unnecessarily rude you are, that's also a very, very bad sign. That, to me, that's kind of like saying, there must have been trouble on the set. Because for an editor or a director to let that line in, and there's more than one line about that in this movie, that shows that there was some bad feelings going on behind the scenes. At least that's what it seems to me. And this movie was produced by Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg, along with a guy named Steven Levinson. And you can look them all up on in the supplementals and all the rest of it. So that's pretty bad. But it gets worse because this movie also features the Indonesian actor and action star Iko Uwais. I may not be pronouncing that right. However, I'm pronouncing it the way it's kind of spelled. And again, you can go to the supplementals and see. And also, in the supplementals, I'll try to include how to pronounce his name correctly, unless if that was incorrect. He's in this movie. He's an awesome martial artist. If you've seen The Raid and The Raid 2, which I highly recommend, if you haven't, then you can see how talented he is. So he's in this movie. So I said, okay, I'm going to go see this because he's in it, so that'll at least mean I'll get some decent martial arts. And sure enough, I believe there was decent martial arts in this. Not that you could really see it, because the way Mark Wahlberg's character acts in this movie, Peter Berg directs. Peter Berg directs like a hyperactive a-hole. He didn't use an editing machine. He used a shredder. He used a lawnmower. He used a weed whacker to edit this thing. You can tell there are several sequences where Iko does his thing, and I'm sitting in the audience steaming, because if they had just shot it, just put the camera down and let it go, it would have been pretty awesome. But again, because they're chopping, 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 it's like, at one point, I was very lucky. I was in the theater with one other person. There was only one other person in the movie theater. So I was able to do some of the stuff that Jen is usually mad at me about, because I'll start making noise and I'll start throwing up my hands and I'll be rolling my eyes so hard that they rattle. But thankfully, the other person in the theater, I have to assume, pretty much felt the way about the movie that I did. And I couldn't tell whether he was nodding along with me, but he certainly didn't say, "Hey, shut up." And at one point, it got so bad, and the combination of the shredding editor and the really ridiculous plot and the stupidity of everybody, I had to get up and start walking around. I had to go up and down the aisle. I didn't have to, but I like to have the freedom of doing that. I remember the only other time I really did that was for the Robert Altman musical version of Popeye, where again, it was just so wrongheaded and so not based on the Popeye character that I felt the need to get up and move and walk around. So anyway, that's pretty bad, right? We already have a terrible lead character. We already have a horrible thing that the director has done. I'm not blaming the editor. I do not feel this is the editor's fault in any way. I feel this came on instructions from on high. I cannot believe that the editor sat alone in his editing bay and just said, I'll just cut this to shit. I'm pretty sure that Berg said, yeah, come on, let's make it hip and let's make it cool and let's make it fabulous. Let's make it indecipherable. Incomprehensible. Yeah, the audiences love that. Gosh. So that was pretty tragic. In fact, I'm not going to say anyone was on coke. I'm not cola or drugs. I'm not going to say that. I'm just going to say, from my vantage point, it looked like someone or several someones were. It just played like a movie made on cocaine. And not even a movie like Scarface, which was apparently, according to the A&E behind the story, behind the scenes story documentary, that was done with a lot of cocaine. Certainly on screen, it was a lot of cocaine. But anyway, this one just was erratic and weird. But guess what? That's not the worst of it. The worst of it. All right. You know the theme song for this show. There'll be spoilers. There'll be spoilers. Well, here we go. Here's the spoiler. Turns out, and again, how am I going to describe this succinctly in a artful way or an accurate way or a legitimate way to get it across to you? At the end of this movie, it turns out, after a lot of wonderful characters, most of the really decent characters and good people in this, including Ronda Rousey, are ignominiously killed. In fact, pretty much everybody except the Mark Wahlberg character is killed through the fault of the Mark Wahlberg character. It is his stupidity and rudeness and blunt ignorance, because in other words, he's blunt, but he's not shining lights on anyone with his bluntness. He is just showing how stupid he is with his bluntness. So because he's stupid, because he doesn't think ahead for a nanosecond, things happen in this movie. I mean, again, he's supposed to be option three. He's supposed to be leading a crew of the best of the best. If this is the best of the best, we are in serious trouble. The Rock and Jason Statham and Tom Cruise will have something to say about this, because these guys are awful. These guys are really bad. Agony and bad and ugly and oof. So because of his stupidity and badness, he lets everybody die except Iko Uwais, who turns out to be a double agent all along. And the entire plot of the movie was a setup to destroy this awesome team that Mark Wahlberg is leading. Although through the beneficence of the script, which apparently was by a person named Leah Carpenter, and you can look up that person on the supplementals to see what else they've done. He survives. Mark Wahlberg's character survives for no other reason than the script says so. Because of his stupidity, everyone else dies except Iko, who's an agent, who's a double agent, whose sole job in the entire movie was to set up a sequel The entire movie was to set up a sequel. And at the end of this movie, they're doing the interview, the out interview. Again, I can't think of the effing term, where they're doing the thing that when they bring the agent in after a mission and they're interviewing him about how everything went. Again, I'll put it in the supplementals. I've gone too far in this podcast to think of the effing word. But in any case, so the ending sequence is him ruminating about his failure, except he doesn't consider it a failure. He says, all right, now we're just moving on to the next phase of the operation. He doesn't say, I completely screwed this one up. I'm an idiot. I screwed the pooch. I should have something rammed up various orifices. He doesn't say any of that. He just says, okay, we go on to the next phase of the operation. In part two, or in mile 23, or whatever else they were planning to call it. But I'm happy to report that this movie did so poorly, not as badly as the movie itself, but did so poorly that I pray there won't be a sequel. That I don't think there won't be the next phase of the operation, because the way they set it up by making Ico the double agent who manipulates everybody throughout this movie, but they don't reveal that until the very end. And they let Mark Wahlberg walk away, and after having insulted the audience, insulted his fellow agents, and ruined everything, it's one of the biggest FUs to the audience I can remember seeing. I felt that basically Wahlberg turned and looked at me and just spit on my shoe, or spit in my face. It's like, you know, F you, Rick. F anybody who sees this. Because we think we're so clever and we're so smart. Hey, you weren't expecting us to kill everybody, were you? You weren't expecting that the guy that you were putting your faith into, who's the only decent fighter or action star in this movie, turned out to be the villain. Hey, pretty clever of us, huh? Oh, God, I was pissed. I still am, as you can tell. So enough about that. And now you would think I'd be smart enough to just do my sign-off and tell you to come back next time where we have a wonderful interview, and then we're going to do more reviews later on. But I'm not going to do that, because something else happened recently that I think we should talk about. At least I certainly want to talk about it, because speaking of sequels, there is a movie that is trying to do its 25th segment. They're trying to do their 25th film in this series. And if I had the rights, I would play the James Bond theme now, but I don't. So I'm just going, da-da-da-da, I'll do that. Anyway, I have quite a relationship with James Bond. My first, I'm pretty sure I've told this endlessly on this podcast, my first adult movie, the first movie for adults that wasn't a kiddie matinee that I ever saw was Dr. No back in 1962. So I've been a James Bond fan ever since. James Bond, to a great degree, along with Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot, kind of saved my life, or at least my happiness. It could have been a very difficult time for me if I didn't have Mr. Spock and Joe Friday from Dragnet and others to show me the way, to show me that there was another way rather than misery or giving in to misery or unhappiness. So James Bond is very important to me. So I've survived the transitions. I was pretty unhappy with several of the movies and pretty unhappy with several of the James Bonds. But then Daniel Craig shows up and out comes Casino Royale, which is, I think, again, unarguably the best, or certainly one of the best, of the James Bond movies. So I was very hopeful that they would continue in that vein. Sadly, they did not. And now I'm beginning to believe that it was Martin Campbell, despite the being thrown under the bus by DC and Warner Brothers for the Green Lantern movie, who was largely responsible, more than the star or the producers or even the writers, for the quality of Casino Royale. He just had taste, and he was able to get it through, and they let him get it through. And then, you know, then Quantum of Solace comes out, and that's just awful. I wanted to like it. I had my Phantom Menace moment with Quantum of Solace in that I finished the movie, and I finished seeing the movie at the premiere in New York, and I turned to my friends and went, that was good, huh? Right? That was good, right? And they just looked at me and just lowered and shook their heads. It was like, no, that was not good. And by the time we got to dinner, I sort of went, yeah, you're right, that was not good. Then Skyfall comes out, and Skyfall was a legitimate and enjoyable 50th anniversary James Bond movie that was good, and I was able to, it was so good and was so well made and had so many Oscar winners on the in the crew and in the cast that I was able to overlook the huge gaps in logic in the plot line. Then Spectre came out, and it was another one of those. I was not dumbfounded by Spectre. It was inexplicable to me, however. It wasn't that inexplicable either, because every time the James Bond series had a chance to make up for an error in the past, like when Tracy Bond is killed on Her Majesty's Secret Service, James Bond's wife is murdered, and I thought there was going to be a legitimate response to that, and then I get Diamonds Are Forever, which was a really kind of awful, Bronx cheer kind of response to the murder of James Bond's wife. So they haven't been able to use Blofeld and the organization Spectre for many years because of legalities. And so here we have a movie called Spectre, which I thought, okay, now we are going to be able to correct the error of omission by not having Blofeld and not having Spectre for all these years, because Spectre was the main villain. But when they cast the guy who played Moriarty in the Sherlock show, the BBC show, and they cast Christoph Waltz as Blofeld, I sort of went, that's a little on the nose. I mean, you would think they would hire someone a little smarter to play those parts that weren't so expected. But then again, I said, okay, we're all right. Sam Mendes again, the Oscar-winning Sam Mendes is director, and he did Skyfall. He did a lovely job on Skyfall. So how bad could it be? It was terrible. It made the inexplicableness of Skyfall look like the height of logic. At some point, I'm going to pay off my promises at the beginning of this podcast and actually do an entire episode on the James Bond series and do an episode on Jackie Chan and do an episode on different genres and different whatevers and go through the films one by one. But in any case, until that day comes, I was fascinated by how Spectre could be so bad. In other words, I want to do an entire episode just going through Spectre scene by scene, or Man of Steel scene by scene, and just point out the incredible stupidity of this stuff and how this doesn't make any sense at all from a human movie standpoint. Because humans and movie characters are different. But even from a movie character standpoint, so little made legitimate sense. And it was also like spitting or slapping me in the audience. We don't care enough about you to make this even remotely logical or valid. So Spectre was so weird and so poor, especially with the same cast and crew, that I went after it like a terrier. I went after it like the Meg. I wanted to know why this was so bad. I've been doing that for a while. I did that with The Good Dinosaur, too. I'm still tracking down that enemy. And you've heard some of my wild theories on this podcast before, if you've been a listener on a regular basis. So I went after Spectre. And what I heard from a friend of a friend of a friend, because over the years, as a person who has worked in the industry as an action film lover and somebody who's worked in television and movies and did the Films of Fury movie. And I'm mostly known for the Kung Fu film. I won't say expertise, but love. And also knowledge of Kung Fu. I have developed a network of associates, also because of the Kung Fu Extravaganza at the San Diego Comic-Con. I have met a lot of action directors and a lot of action stars and producers and directors, et cetera, et cetera. And they have become an anonymous network. because I've said to several of them, and I won't tell you who they are because of what I'm about to say, that your secret is safe with me. I am not going to threaten your livelihood, which is another reason why I sometimes don't have certain people on this podcast that I could have, because I'd want them to open up. I'd want them to be honest about the things that happened behind the scenes and why was this action sequence so lousy, et cetera, et cetera. And several of them have told me that they were the fight scenes that they created a great action sequence that was then taken away from them by the producers or the studio and re-edited to make it not as awesome. And there are reasons for that, I'm told, specifically because they don't want to raise the bar so high that the subsequent movies would not be as appreciated by the audience, because then the audience would be expecting better. And when they didn't get better, they would be disappointed, and that could affect the box office. So, all right, that makes us. And also, it takes time. As Jet Li says, in Hong Kong, we worked 4 weeks on the action and 1 week on the drama. In America, we work 1 week on the action and 4 weeks on the drama. And so, of course, the studio doesn't want to work 4 weeks on the drama and 4 weeks on the action, because that will take time, which means money. So I understand all that. Even so, as an audience member, come on. I want to cheer. I want to be involved. I want to be happy. So in any case, so I went after and I asked the network. I said, "What's up with Spectre?" And I was told by more than one source that now producer Daniel Craig had a lot of power on that set, and didn't always. It wasn't always for the better, because if you've read the interviews or heard about how Daniel Craig felt about James Bond at that time, the famous quote, which he may or may not have said, which is he would rather, you know, either eat glass or cut his wrists with broken glass or whatever the phrase was, the quote was, then go back to James Bond or do James Bond again. And it wasn't a happy camper. And Spectre was not a happy movie. So let's get to the point. The reason I bring all of this up is that Bond 25, which is supposed to be the last James Bond movie starring Daniel Craig, I was hoping Spectre would be, because it pretty much ended his particular Bond story. And also, the Craig Bonds are so anal. They're so navel-gazing. The heads are so far up their own rectums that I could have done with a change. I was looking for Tom Hardy or Tom Hiddleston to play a more Fleming-esque Bond, or to have Christopher Nolan take his Honor Majesty's Secret Service homage from Inception and turn that into an entire movie or whatever. But no, they got Craig for like whatever, tens of millions of dollars. So Craig is back, and couldn't get a director, couldn't get a finished script. And finally they said they had a director who was Danny Boyle, the Oscar winning director Danny Boyle. And suddenly all the James Bond fans, not suddenly, but all the James Bond fans that I'm aware of, including other podcasts, we're ecstatic. Yay, Danny Boyle. He's going to be great. He's going to really bring something to it. And he had a very specific idea, which we're not sure of yet, and a script by one of his trusted collaborators. And he walks in there, and I'm sitting in my seat or standing in my movie theater or going to my San Diego Comic-Con with my nose up in the air and my chin out saying, I give him 2 weeks. So about a week ago, I guess, the announcement came from the James Bond camp, Eon Productions, which stands for Everything or Nothing. Well, it's now nothing, because the announcement came out that Danny Boyle was no longer going to be doing the Bond 25. He had stepped out as producer, and I found it most intriguing that on the short Twitter in the official James Bond account, They mention the producers, Barbara Broccoli and Michael Wilson, but they also mention Daniel Craig, because Daniel Craig is a full producer. So I sort of went, okay, there we go. As I figured, what has happened in the past, or what I've observed in the past, is that an actor goes through their career getting rejected, getting criticized. I see that as Santa Claus. I see children getting constantly being told no, constantly being controlled, constantly being told what to do. And I see the result with children, and I also see the result with actors, that once they're given any power, they kind of go a little crazy with control. You know, it becomes what I call show business, B-I-S-S, which stands for because I said so. And they don't say black because it's black. They say black because you said white. And I've seen that in many businesses, not just in entertainment. But I've seen it especially in entertainment, because then people who enter the entertainment business, and people enter politics for a reason, they enter show business for a reason, and usually that reason is that they want to have power, that they feel, they enter marketing for oftentimes for the same reason, because they feel powerless and insecure, and this way they can have power over people they resent, you know, creative people or whatever. So anyway, I'm going to be very interested to see what happens with Bond 25, if something happens with Bond 25, especially after, and let's get back to my happy place, Mission Impossible Fallout. After I saw it, I put up a message on Facebook which said, "Good luck, Mr. Bond, you'll need it." And this was before the information that Danny Boyle was going to leave over creative differences. Because the bar is set very high indeed. And considering the way that there have been more mediocre and bad James Bond movies than good ones, or even great ones, I'm happy to say that if there is not another James Bond movie in my lifetime, I'll be okay with that. That's sad. And on that sad note, I'll be also very happy if there's another Mission Impossible movie, or the spin-off with Jason Statham and The Rock from The Fast and Furious. I will also be extremely happy that there'd be a new James Bond movie before there would ever be another Mile 22. On that note, use your blinkers, jackass. And now let me look closely into the distance and see if I can hear Miko and Jen call out, "And chew your food, Rick."
Okay, break it up, break it up. For now.
You don't give up, do you?
Listen in next time for more film fun, frenzy, and friends. Until then, check out actionfilmautopsy.com, where the excitement never ends.